Welcome to another episode of Jack Theology. This is two in a row, so we're doing pretty good here in the spring.
Yeah, good to see you, Matt.
Dr. Matt Martin, with Kevin. Good to see you. Good afternoon. Yeah, I saw you posted this week about your book, pre-sale up. It's all everywhere, so I guess it's getting real, huh?
Yeah, it is getting real. I'm looking forward to it. It's kind of weird to be now like self-marketing. I'm not a guy who really loves that kind of self-marketing thing. I have no idea how many have been pre-ordered. You know, I'm kind of holding my, I don't know that I want to know, honestly, because like the last time I heard, like a month ago, it was like 9 on Amazon. So
wow.
You know, me and a dozen of my friends are going to really enjoy this book. Yeah. So both of us who read it will hopefully have made it worth a year of my life.
It's funny because I pre-ordered it. This time on, I clicked on the link for Amazon and it said I already had pre-ordered. And so then I was like, oh, well, I'll just go buy, I'll go pre-order it on Barnes & Noble. So I got each site for you.
You're the man. So thanks, Matt. If everybody had friends like you.
I'm sure you'll get stuff out there. It's 25% off. Is it still 25% off?
No, it's not. That deal was only for a couple of days. They seem to do that maybe every 3 months or so. So maybe one will hit again beforehand.
Okay. But get out there, pre-order it. 25% is only a couple bucks, so whatever.
Yeah. Us poor pastors, you can help support us. By
yeah. Support Kevin by buying his book. Yeah, like, subscribe this, share this. I know it's always good to hear from you too. So if you could comment in the different apps that you watch or listen to this, that'd be great. Or text us. I know a couple folks have reached out, so that's encouraging as well to hear from people that actually listen. Because sometimes you wonder if people are actually listening, but it's nice.
It is. It's great. We love to hear your comments, your feedback, your ideas of what you'd like us to talk about.
Yeah, ideas, content, things you disagreed with. Maybe we'll make that content and argue with you or agree with you. Maybe you make a good point. How's your kids? We were talking about kids before we went live. Little life update. What are your kids up to these days, Kevin?
Kids are doing well. They're involved in everything. You know, it's sports season, it's choir season, it's band season, end of the school year. Everybody's trying to fit everything in. I have four kids. You have four kids. This is the first time tonight where all of my kids have something at the same time on different places around town. So the girls have a choir concert, my boy has a band concert, and my other boy has a baseball tournament. So there are three events and two parents. And so one of the kids, you know, is like, "Yeah, sorry." It probably will be one of the middle kids, because, you know, I mean, I wanted to make sure that they have that full middle child experience.
that is one of the reasons why Kelly and I try to make friends fast. When they join, our oldest, he joined the wrestling team, and I was like, we need to make friends fast with some of the parents so that we can get rides. So we are very friend dependent on helping our kids get rides. Cause I've been in that situation where we're going four different directions and there's two of us. And if we can't find friends, sometimes that means I drop a kid off 30 minutes early or 30 minutes late. So the joys of parenting four kids.
The ride situation is chaos. And then it's like, well, you're not going to come see me. I'm like, I don't want to see any of y'all, but I feel as though I have not done my job unless my kids are in therapy. So, you know, what are you doing to help support the economy? I am ensuring that my kids are in therapy for the rest of their lives, supporting the economy through their their psychology.
As Biden would say, it helps the economy. that meme that's out there. But it's funny because like I see these blogs about parenting or these tweets about parenting, about, you know, being at your kids' stuff, supporting them. And I laugh because I was like, clearly they don't have four kids, because it's impossible to be at all your kids' stuff when you have four kids. Either they'll be in therapy or they're very gracious children. we'll find out.
And my kids are great kids. One of the downsides to being a pastor is oftentimes pastors tend to move around a lot. Some pastors have the blessing, I guess it's a blessing of being in one place for a very long time, but a large majority of pastors tend to be a little bit more itinerant and staying in a place for only like 3 to 7 years. And so, we've been at a couple of different locations over the course of their childhood. And it's fascinating. They all now kind of use this line. They say this, they look back on it and they say, we're kind of thankful for that because we feel like it made us closer as brothers and sisters than if we would have stayed in one place our whole lives. Because we're now living in a place where people kind of stay their whole lives. And they see that their friends are only friends with other friends, not with their siblings. Like they don't have the same sibling relationships that my kids do. So it's kind of fun to see as they get a little bit older for those ties to be really strong between kids who grew up having to move around. And I know that's not just a pastor thing. Other professions do that. The Army is another one of those oftentimes that, families can have to move. So it's being a parent is not for the faint of heart.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good point. There is pluses to moving and being around. I know it's tough in some sense, but it can be positive in other areas. I know for me, it helped me. I moved a lot as a kid, and it just helped me be able to adapt to new situations quickly. And I've seen that with my kids because we moved around some, and so they're adaptable, which I like. I think that's a good life skill. So today last week we talked kind of about community, developing community in a church and what that looks like, good, bad, and the ugly. And, a topic that came up and we kind of mentioned and kind of sidebarred it, this would be a great episode. And so I thought we'd address it, today, cause we kind of both was on our hearts this week and different things we posted on social media, kind of like what we both would probably agree that we're in a new reformation, kind of a new reforming. And it seems like if you look through church history, there is a reforming of the church about every 500 years. And we're at that threshold since the last reformation, probably the most famous one, at least in our culture, the Luther 96, is it 96 theses that he's hit out. Staple to the
there
wall.
Were a lot of them. He had a lot of points.
Yeah. He had a lot.
There's
imagine
a lot of
that sermon.
There.
Dude, yeah. That sermon probably.
I'd rather not. Though I have said it some, growing up independent fundamental Bible believing Baptist, I have sat in many a sermon that I think had that many points or felt like it did. An altar call is just as long. We're going to sing 96 verses of this until somebody comes forward. And so somebody eventually, comes forward and everybody's just like, thank you, Jesus.
Yeah, I remember.
Sister Martha's getting saved again, but we're grateful for it.
When my pastor would do like a 25-minute introduction, he's like, now, 5 reasons, da-da-da. And I'm like, oh, my gosh.
And then they spent like 40 minutes on the first one. You're like, I'm dying. These said, better not be equal. And then like 2 minutes on the rest of them because, they'd start to feel people getting restless. The worst, though, oh, my God, were revivals every night. And those things, nobody's waiting to get to Sizzler at the end of a midweek revival. So, they're there for as long as you want them.
Yeah, I did a lot of
the church needs reformation. I guess that's the point, right?
Yeah. My mom was gracious. She'd play tic-tac-toe with me and those things. So the new reformation, you had tweeted, we'll probably read these here. I had a tweet and you had a tweet and we'll kind of riff off those. So you said the Catholic Church of today is not one of the Reformation. It changed for the better. The Protestant Church of today is not the one of the Reformation. It changed and much of it has become what it revolted against, an empire addicted to power, money, and doctrinal error. And then I kind of like took that a little bit further, I guess, more specific, more nuanced, but similar in thought. I said that the church gave up the sacraments for spiritual disciplines, kind of moved from the Catholic tradition to the Protestant tradition. And we traded love of neighbor for individual piety, which has led to condemnation of and isolation from the neighbor. I think, we look at the history of the church and the Reformation of the past. We see the Catholic Church and the sacramental theology being, you know, the heart behind it was actually to be about the people, right? That we want to care for our neighbor. We want to love our neighbor. We want to do what's right. And no matter what level of life you're at, whether you were down, you know, you're the lowest of low or you were the king of the castle, your heart in that was to be about the community, would do what was best for the community, whether it was protect, provide. And so everything you did was about the community and not just for yourself. And so what broke that down is then the church, you know, the one with that everything was centered around. If you look at these old towns, everything was centered around the church. And so, it broke down because the church was getting greedy, right? And power hungry. It was aligning itself with power. It was, doing indulgences where you had to pay money to get forgiveness of sins, which is crazy. And in some sense, we still do that the Evangel Protestant Church does that still, and brought that back. But, you know, and so the people revolted, right? And so that's when Luther's like, this is awful. This is what we shouldn't have. And so then it became less about the sacramental life and caring for the community and more about taking care of yourself, like, and being better in yourself, and a better self creates a better community in a world. And the heart behind that, I think, was positive, like, and good, like, yeah, let's make a better world. Let's center ourselves in Christ through these spiritual disciplines. But over time, what I think is now happening is same thing, right? It's, we're aligning ourselves with power because that's going to help better ourselves and ultimately our Christian community. We're aligning ourselves with greed. It's bettering ourselves, right? The health, wealth gospel is a big thing behind that. And then also we create these boundaries. We create, because of the piety of the spiritual disciplines, our morality. A lot for I think a lot of the Protestant church, it's become, we come to church to be moral, good moral humans. And so we create boundaries around what that means. And so we try to keep a lot of people out. And so people are kind of waking up and like, I don't know if we should keep that person out. You know, that kind of reeks. So now people are pushing out. They're becoming X, fill in the blank, or just they're not engaging in church. And so the Reformation, I think, of today, and we could talk about this some, is like, it is a hodgepodge of things. There's not one like thing, like out of the Protestant Reformation, the Protestant church came. Today, there's a Reformation, and I don't know what is coming out of it. I think that kind of remains to be seen, but there's clearly a shift.
Yeah. Fear, you know, fear is coming out of it, right? We hope that something good is coming out of it. And I think, you know, I think it can be assumed that something good will always come out of Reformation, and maybe something bad always comes out of things being reformed as well. I guess I'm just kind of speaking off the top of my head, but, you know, whenever things deconstruct and reconstruct, you know, whenever things reform, there's always some things I think that are left behind, and there are always some things that are taken to move forward. And you kind of hope that it's, you know, you're taking the good things forward with you and leaving the bad things behind. In a lot of ways, the Catholic Church, I think, did that in the Reformation, though the Catholic Church was about problems in the Reformation. If you follow the trajectory of the Catholic Church after the Reformation 500 years ago, they fixed a lot of the issues that they had internally because of that Reformation. So it ended up being extremely painful to the Roman Catholic Church, the Reformation itself, almost in a way that feels catastrophic probably in some places within the RCC, but it ended up being a very positive thing. Now, that's not to say that there aren't issues within the Catholic Church. I'm sure that there are there. I don't know them or care to speak on them, but I know that probably many Roman Catholics point to things that are going on in the Catholic Church today and say we might need a new reforming of some things. I hear a lot of my Catholic friends saying a lot of things that my Protestant things are saying about the influence of ultra-conservatism and Trumpism and this idea of individual, like you pointed out, the need of the individual superseding the need and the best for the many, which is something that we're kind of always talking about here as well. For the Protestant church, I think, you know, you kind of pointed out the same thing, that it may have started well with great intent and done a lot of great things, but this focus on sola and on individual and on singular kind of reinforces this idea of personal and individual piety. And I love how you put that, how it ends up kind of being, I think, a negative, if not catastrophic, rabbit trail away from scripture, which is what we're kind of seeing and speaking against in a lot of things here on Jack Theology within our denominations and theology of origin. Phyllis Tickle, who talked about this idea of the cycles of Reformation every 500 years in the church, made this point that I think really reinforces what you said, in that Reformation and reforming is a necessary thing in order to continue the survival of something. Specifically, the church needs to reform seemingly every 500 years or so in order to survive. And so each of these reformations were painful, she points out, but she says that each of them were kind of necessary to the church being able to accomplish what that next leg of the journey, 500 years or so, was going to need, that they had been doing for 500 years wasn't going to fit and meet those needs anymore. I've spent a lot of time over the years researching church health. Churches have the same kind of similar arc. It's not 500 years. Most congregations and churches have an arc of about 40 years. And you can kind of see you can watch it on a curve of growth from the plant to the energy, and the energy cresting about 30 years, 20 to 30 years or so into a church's life cycle, if it lasts that long, if it survives. And then it starts into this decline. And in that decline period, unless something is done or changed, unless it's reformed or deconstructed and reconstructed into something that is new, that's healthy, that's vibrant, that leaves behind all the stuff that got it to where it is and reframes what the current needs are for 40 years later from where it began, it won't survive. We see a lot of churches that are dying. Most of them are somewhere in that 40 to 50 to 60 year old length in their existence. And the ones that are dying kind of refuse to make changes, to reform. What they end up doing is they end up trying to go back to what made them grow in the first place, and that's just a millstone around their neck that kills them. And I think that we see a lot of that in Protestantism, where it is trying to go back to what got it to where it is here, and it's just not going to work.
That's good. You made me think of the text that I'm preaching this week from the lectionary, which I think is very relevant here. The whole pruning and abiding in the true vine, the vine dresser passage, and so how the vine dresser cuts off the branches that don't produce fruit. And I think that's what the process of the reformations are, is the cutting off of the branches that aren't producing fruit any longer and dealing with that. It's a pruning process, I think. Yeah, in churches, I mean, go that specific. Churches forever have a branch that produces fruit, like you say, and then it doesn't produce fruit any longer. But because it was the thing that helped propel the church forward for so long, the churches are blind to see that it's not producing fruit anymore, or maybe it's rotten fruit that's coming out of it. And to cut that off is very painful, right? It causes conflict. And even taking it personally, like, you know, we're in the gardening season where people are putting their gardens in, their vegetable gardens, and things I've learned over the years doing that is actually pruning helps grow the plant better, produce bigger fruit, bigger tomatoes, all those things. And actually cutting those things is hard because you're looking at a plant that looks like great. Oh, this is growing. There's a lot of growth here. But what you learn over time is you want to cut it back so that the fruit is stronger and better and all that thing. And even for the vine dresser, for those that are pruning it, it's difficult. So in church leadership, I know that it's tough to do that because it's like, well, you see this thing happening. People are coming. People like it. They're invested. But it's not producing the fruit. How do you do that? Like, and you're right. Churches have to, especially now, because so many people are leaving the church. People don't want to come to church. I think church leadership, church boards are going to have to make tough decisions on what to cut and how to reform their own churches. I think is how that's a good point that you bring up. I think with that, so part of the problem, and I think we're here because of the Protestant Reformation, where the church is in decline, because I think kind of taking this idea of the Protestant Reformation, the sola, the individual self, producing that. A lot of folks came to church for their morality, for learning how to be a good Christian, right?
Right.
Yeah. And they don't have to come to church anymore to get that, right? Our kids are involved in all sorts of things. I don't know if you've experienced this, but I've experienced it, where in those things, they're teaching him these Christian values and principles and how to love their teammates and their friends and how to not be a bad, unkind person and how to serve. Like my kids' swim team, we do service projects, right? We're teaching these kids all these values of that the church for so long taught. And so by and large, the culture doesn't need the church anymore. Like why would I go to the church? But when it's actually doing it worse, because there's so many boundaries set up at different churches it's in an unkind way. And so people are like, well, why would I be a part of that? Right. And so I think the church has a lot of things to deal with. If we want to move into the future, it's going to have to look a lot different. I have no idea what that looks like, but
yeah, no, the church has a publicity problem, and you know, that sounds very unchristian and saying that you shouldn't use the word publicity in relation to the church or to God. Okay, well, whatever. The church has a publicity problem that's well-deserved. They have spoken out of one side of their mouth, love of neighbor, and out of the other side of their mouth, they've continued to do things that have made their neighbor's life more difficult or more miserable, oftentimes specifically related to neighbors that are unlike them. Here in the United States of America, depending on your social class, depending on your race, depending on your voting preferences or social ideologies, and now specifically, you know, sexuality, gender, et cetera, et cetera. The church says, love your neighbor on one side of their mouth, but treats, votes, gives its money in ways that to the neighbor sound not only unlike love, but translate to you dislike me, to you want to make my life more difficult, to you don't understand me and the situation that I'm in. You're so disconnected that you don't understand what you're doing, how your theology, how the practice of your faith harms me, to the extreme of you actually hate me. And it's easy sometimes to understand from an outside perspective how people not only feel that way, but are actually treated that way by the church. But yet the church oftentimes recoils from that and says, no, we're loving you by doing these things. Well, to me, that says, first of all, you have a broken theology, but let's say that your theology isn't broken, that you're right, but the world still feels this way. So what happens is you're in an echo chamber that is so disconnected from the reality of how the actions and the words that you say and that you do translate to other people that you've completely lost, disconnected from the people who you're trying to reach, trying to create community and conversation and conversion, for lack of a better word, with. So it doesn't surprise me that people would prefer to find their morality through educating themselves in other ways. Because why would you risk involving yourself in an institution that from the outside does more harm than good? And until the church is able to wake up to the idea of the possibility or the potential that it does more harm than good, I don't know how much hope there is for avoiding a complete and utter meltdown, the likes of which the Great Reformation experienced 500 years ago. It feels almost unavoidable at this point for the church to be completely kind of destructed and broken down and rebuilt into something new.
I see very much just a remnant, you know, and then I'm thinking through, like, how do you even begin to rebuild that? And it's it's daunting, but I think in some sense, and this is kind of, you know, where I feel a pull in it, you know, based on your writing, your new book, it, you know, the old ancient ways of the sacramental life, I think is what pulls us back in, because the sacramental life doesn't make Christianity and your faith about your morality, and what you do or choices you make. It just invites you to the table of Christ, you know, and it trusts the Spirit that if you're not walking the right way, that the Spirit will fix that, right? Will change your heart, will and I move in that way. I know for me, like in my own life, just my own morality and how I live, like if somebody like points a finger at me and tells me I shouldn't be doing that, da da da, like I'm less likely to change that thing. I'm gonna get very defensive, right? And then, but if I get invited into something, into a new way of living, into a different way of living, those things just, maybe I don't even consciously think about them. They just kind of happen, right? Naturally. And then there's no battle over like some issue in my life that maybe the Spirit is going to fix anyways or change in me anyways. So I think the approach is just so wrong. And then, yeah, to your point, like, and let's be honest, like where Christians seem to draw the line in the sand is like people's sexuality. And, you know, it's so disheartening, so sad to see like that line in the sand be drawn. It drives so many people.
Yeah, it's yeah. Ridiculous. I mean, this is not a biblical issue. It's, you know, the church has taken a cultural issue on as its own spiritual. Like, you cannot look at Scripture and come away in any way, shape, or form with God cares as strongly about sexuality and these conversations that we're having today as the church is caring about them, you know. And so the world is, I mean, the church has taken what, if you include the clobber verses, you know, about LGBTQ, and then you include verses that may or may not tacitly have to do with marriage or man or woman, like you've got what, a dozen, maybe at most 12 verses out of tens of thousands in the Bible that reference possibly in any way, shape, or form sexuality, and yet you've made it like 90-100% of your theology that you talk about and that you care about and you vote about today. Like there's a breakdown here somewhere in the church where, you know, 0.1% of Scripture talks in any way, shape, or form references sexuality or gender, and yet it's all that you talk and care about. You have been led by culture in this rather than leading culture. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's insanity, insane, Matt.
We've made it our identity, and our identity is supposed to be Christ. Our identity is supposed to be Christ. Our identity is supposed to be Christ crucified. Our identity is supposed to be love of neighbor, and our validation of our faith is love for one another. Jesus says, you're going to know who are mine by how they love each other.
Yeah.
That's our identity. But no, our identity is the party that we vote for, our stance on LGBTQ issues, whether or not you're an abolitionist, pro-life, pro-choice. Like,
yeah.
I just, I'm going to go home. I'm just done.
It's very special. Yeah, that's nice.
I like this rolly chair.
hey, if you're
just going to roll off screen, man. I'm done.
Like I was a couple weeks ago, you'd get rolled away. That'd be awesome. That's fine.
Sorry, I went off on a tangent there.
Do this Bible study on Rutgers campus and literally 90% of the people that come are gay, lesbian, or non-binary, queer, and they come because, you know, they want community, they want to have a discussion about God in a safe place, and so it's been very interesting to hear their stories of faith and their journeys in the church, and just their kids, you know, these are kids. stepping into adulthood, and their whole story is about their childhood of being just ridiculed, of being condemned by the church, of being told they're going to hell. And these folks that draw these lines in the sand say that's love. Like, that's how we're loving this community. And it's like, really? Like, none of these people felt love, you know, and they're broken, they're hurt, yeah. And they're, you know, they're angry, all of the fill in the blank, you know. And it's like, it's so sad to see the church be the reason that's happened, when we have Jesus who would be with them, right? Because they're the outcasts of society, and that's who Jesus went to. And yet the church, you know, continues to kick them out, kicked them to the curb. And then kick us to the curb who want to support and love and care for them, which that's another fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. The church needs reformed, needs reformation on this issue. I feel safe and secure in saying this. This is a unproven statistically statement I'm about to make. Maybe it can be proven, but I'm not aware that it has been. So this is completely and utterly anecdotal. The strongest people of faith with the deepest spiritual maturity that I know are a part of the LGBTQ community. I today trust far and away the spiritual health and maturity of LGBTQ people who are people of faith than I do anybody else. The depths there are just unbelievable whenever you begin to interact and, like you said, begin to hear stories of what they've gone through and how they continue to fight for faith, to fight for inclusion, to fight to be seen as being able to simply be a follower of Jesus. Like I can't even begin to fathom what it feels like to have people say to you, no, you can't be a follower of Jesus just because of this one thing that you can't change about yourself and has always been true. It's maddening, and the church has to begin to look these things in the face and reform their thinking on these things. Where we are, no matter what your theology on this, I think I can confidence that no matter what where your theology is on LGBTQ issues, the church is not in a healthy place on the topic, and is not in a biblical or Christ-centered place in their handling and where they are on this. It needs to be from top to bottom.
Yeah, I would say 100%. And I'm glad you hit on that, because I think, you know, the theology isn't what we're talking about today. There's other podcasts where we've talked about that. But the way you treat others that disagree with your theology or live a different lifestyle than you believe a Christian should live has to change. And it has to start at the top, because I posted something a week or two ago. You know, Richard Hayes is coming out with a book in September, who was a very conservative theologian. We read his book at Cedarville, and he's coming out affirming, right? And writing a theological book. And he's one of the top theologians in his field, New Testament scholar, well-respected. And I posted it as, hey, does anybody, when this book comes out, want to have a discussion about this topic? And just me asking, I didn't say where I stood. I mean, people can probably assume, but like, I just said, you want to have a discussion. And I got, you know, denominational people from my old denomination call me out, you know, privately for that. And it's like, really, we're not even allowed to talk about this and how we respond to this. Like, it's very controlled, very structured. And if you have any other opinion than the powers that be, you're cast out, right? You're spanked, you're kicked to the curb. And so the church has to change.
Yeah. You know, it feels a little like the Catholic Church of 1500.
Exactly.
Right?
It's a lot like that, right?
The Protestant church has become...
It's completely become that. It's tied to money. It's tied... Like, why are they doing that? Because it's politics, yeah. Right? Because their money in these churches are tied to Republican politics. Let's be honest. And supporting the LGBTQI community doesn't jive with Republican politics. And so their money is in this old boomer Republican money, and so they're making the decisions based on that. Because if I talk to these people privately and just friend to friend, they would agree with me. But publicly, we can't have that, right? Which is very fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It's true. Unfortunately, I think most pastors would attest to this, that a greater amount of their funding comes from more conservative rather than more progressive situations. Now, obviously, that doesn't hold in every church and for every individual and for every denomination. But in general, especially within evangelicalism, it is that way. And it has become increasingly that way as, you know, we've come through kind of these Reagan years and especially Trump years and where we are now. And people tie their giving increasingly more strongly to how vocal the church is in alignment with their thinking politically than they used to. I think it's been that way for a long time, but it's increasingly becoming more and more that way in a lot of churches, especially within evangelicalism. And the evangelical church has become the Catholic Church of 500 years ago. It is strongly, if not solely, dedicated to empire and to power and to enforcing its theological hang-ups on the broader culture, not just its adherents. And that's problematic.
Very problematic. You know, you hear statements like, when we take power, we'll eliminate these guys like Kevin and Matt. You know, they'll be silenced, whatever that means.
Yeah, that's what's said.
It's scary, but it needs reforming. Hopefully, I mean, I think we're seeing too a big exodus. There are a lot of passionate, influential talking heads, but by and large, I mean, people are leaving or rejecting that. I mean, especially the young people, the younger generation coming up. I was just, you know, I can see, you know, on a college campus, and I worked and helped with college ministry about 15 years ago, and the change in involvement from Christian students has changed dramatically, you know? And so I think the younger generation is rejecting it more and more. So I think, yeah, there's a lot there, and it's like, wow, what's going to happen in the next 20 years with the church? I think a lot of these mega churches, evangelical Protestant, you know, even non-evangelical Protestant that are caught up in this are losing foothold or losing people. And so, in some ways there's danger there. Like there's like, cause there are still, I think there, you know, mega churches are like a cockroach. They're going to be around for a while. But a lot of the mega churches are just consolidating, right?
Wait. Did you just call mega churches cockroaches? Did you really call mega churches cockroaches? That's, I don't want that to pass. I need to hit pause for just a moment and point that out.
The semiotics of that, you could take that however you want. And I probably meant all the things you're thinking. But most, you know, let's be honest, most mega churches are just consolidating, you know, dying churches together. And so that can only last so long. And so, yeah, I think we are definitely.
Yeah, growth in mega churches does not generally happen by conversion as much as just converting from other churches that are doing it less well than mega churches. Not everyone. Not every person who attends a mega church is coming from another church, but
yeah, almost. I mean, God uses everything. He uses all our mess. Like he uses stuff to draw people to himself. He will. And even in churches that don't do it well and churches that do, you know, all of the above. Yeah, I agree. But by and large, I mean, you and I have been around that world and we, you know, we've experienced it firsthand. So I think that, yeah. So I'm just concerned, you know, so there's a lot of they call it ex-evangelical movement, and the data showing that. There's just a new study that came out that I read that obviously the church is continuing to shrink and at a higher rate than, you know, before COVID. COVID kind of, you know, accelerated that.
Yeah, it's so accelerating. Yeah.
I guess maybe how we, you know, transition here is like, where's the hope? Like, what are some ideas that are percolating in your brain for how we reform the church? What do we see moving forward? The church, in church doing in this new reformation?
Yeah, I'm really interested in what you think here, because I know that you kind of live in this world maybe even a little bit more than I do. You know, I thought about this a little earlier when you were talking, and just again, just kind of welled up within me whenever you asked the questions to what do we do, where do we go, how do we begin to reform and change these things. We've been utilizing the word church to mean an institution, a building, an empire. Most of us will understand, and if not, you should, that church as it's used in the Bible means a group of people, not a building, not a place. But everybody of all time, you know, past, present, and future, who is a follower of Jesus Christ, who's been kind of called out to live differently. And so I think, you know, to answer that question, it begins with me. It begins with individuals, if things are ever going to change. And I think that this is the power and the beauty of what I see in a lot of ex-evangelical, post-evangelical people who are deconstructing, or if you prefer a different word, disentangling, trying to come to a place where they have disconnected from a lot of the toxicity that they see within evangelicalism, within Protestantism, within the Catholic Church, and get back to something that more mirrors the early church and what Christ, I think, had in mind for those who would follow him. I think that's the first step, is to change ourselves, to begin to radically assess and reform our own faith. The second thing, though, that I think that has to happen there is we have to begin to publicly live that out, even if it brings us to the place where we are martyrs in our church, in our families, in our communities, in our workplaces, in our denominations. And I think that that's right now where a lot of people are, you know, in this kind of trajectory of reformation. You know, we feel like we're not yet where the church has reformed, but we think that the church needs to do reforming. Many of us, we're not even yet at that point of what it should look like or what it will look like. So it feels like we're in this very early stage. And I think a lot of people have come to the place where they're not happy with what was, and they understand kind of that things need to change, and they've begun work on themselves. But I don't think that they've yet got to the point, many of us, where we feel comfortable speaking publicly about where we are or what our frustration is, because we understand we're gonna have to wear that scarlet letter. You know, we are gonna get taken to task by people, pastors, friends, who know a lot more about us. I mean, who know a lot more about theology than we do. So it can be very difficult to say, I believe that this is wrong and this is not okay, whenever you know that a lot of people are gonna come at you with a lot of questions and verses and things that you can't defend on your own. So you go quiet and stay hidden. I don't think that that's the right move at all. I think it's frankly absolutely okay. I realize it's tough, but it's okay for you to stand out there and say, what I see is not okay. I don't fully understand all of the theology or all of the biblical reasons. I can't argue or debate you into the ground as to why you're wrong and I'm right. I think it's okay to say, I don't need to do that and I don't care to do that. I just know in my heart that is filled with the Holy Spirit that this is not the way of Jesus. And that's, I think, for me, if I'm looking at how to begin to reform, it's calling on individuals who are discontent to understand that that is a holy discontent, that that is from God, and to begin to reconcile with yourself the need to be transparent about that. To, I'm sorry, but come out of the closet.
I agree with that. Yeah, I think.
So I don't know. What do you think?
You know, to piggyback, to build on what you were saying, I agree with all what you're saying. I think what you stated will lead to, I think, a couple of things. I was thinking more organizationally as the broader church, but yeah, it starts with ourselves. I agree. We have to stand up. We have to speak out.
Well, I think that's the only way to change the organization, but there is need for organizations as well.
Yeah, no, I think I'll give some thoughts on that, but like, I get a lot of pushback, and I think it's a fear. It may, you know, you and I think are designed a little bit more to like speak out boldly. I hear that, oh, Matt, you're so bold, and I don't feel bold. I just feel like I'm being me. But I've come to learn that like my personality, I guess, is a little bit more leans that way. So it may not look exactly the same way it looks for me, for you, but like, yeah, you've got to speak up boldly in your world, whether it's in conversations with folks. I can remember recently I was around a fire pit with some people and they were getting racist, right? And they ended kind of their thought and there was a back and forth and they said, you know what we mean? You know what I mean? And I go, no, I don't know what you mean. What do you mean? And you know, and just kind of like, even in those moments, like not backing off, like finding ways to stand against some of that, I think can be powerful and create good conversation. And it also could alienate you. In that moment, for me, I got a little bit alienated. Were you calling us racist? I'm like, if the shoe fits. But it really seemed like that was where this was headed.
Hey, if the white robe fits, you know, just go ahead and put it on.
The prophet, I read this morning, I was reading something that the prophet, prophetic, when you give a prophetic word, can be very lonely at times. And so, yeah, at times it can be lonely. But I think organizationally, I've said this a lot, like finding a way to engage the sacraments, to enter into the presence of Jesus, to abide in Jesus. And that's part of what you were saying, work on yourself. But I think being in a community that wants to be a part of the sacraments, partaking in the Lord's Supper, because there's just something spiritual that happens in that process. I think that's important for the church if we're going to be called back. And I'd like to see the sacraments being made important again, in the ancient ways that, you know, we've talked a lot about on this podcast. I'd like to see those things be made important again, because, you know, when you look at those things, we're not creating boundaries where we decide who's in and out, right? Everybody's welcome and to engage in those things. And so I think the less boundaries we have, and then, you know, the Good Shepherd talk last week is like, you know, the Good Shepherd goes after all the sheep. And so I think organizationally, we need to be open to everyone being part of our organization and not trying to say, well, you, because you did this or that, you can't be a part of this. Those two things, the sacraments and just being open and welcoming to all, I think are huge, to me, huge steps in seeing the church change.
Yeah, I love what you said about the I love what you say about the sacraments, that you're focusing on that. You know, you know, whenever I hear sacraments, a lot of time I hear practices, spiritual practices, you know, the living out of your faith. And I do think that one of the downsides to the Protestant Reformation is this way too strong, stringent, concrete idea of the importance of theology and doctrine. You know, it's not as though the word of God, meaning, you know, here when I say that, the Bible, the text, is unimportant. It's not as though doctrine or theology is unimportant, but to make it of first or primary importance, as the Reformation did, is counterproductive. And I like what you're talking about in reforming, is going back to elevating these practices to be on par or even greater than the doctrine of the text. Rather than it being a word or theology or doctrine-based faith, that we begin to see our faith as a practice-based faith. And if you look back to the early church, first few hundred years, the time of greatest growth in the church over those 2,000 years. It was in those first few hundred years when there was no text, you know, when there was no Bible, when it was a practice-based faith. And I think that you hit on something that's so important, that we have to return to these ideas of sacraments and of spiritual practices and the power of those to reconnect us, not just to God, but also to community and to our neighbor. I think it is the game changer in this new Reformation.
I mean, call me jacked, and some people will think I'm jacked by saying this, but I think we could learn from our Muslim friends. And again, just watching college campus life, you know, the most probably engaged religious group is the Islam community, and dude, they're so sacramental, so practice oriented. Yeah. And people engage in it, and they take their faith serious, and they just let, and like sacraments, the sacraments pull us into Christ, right? Because our sacraments are all built around Christ. So don't, you know, we're not doing the Muslim practices, but I think we can learn from other faiths, and our sacraments are built around Christ. And just by doing the practice, we get pulled into Jesus, and actually we live and look more like Jesus while we do that. We don't have to think about it. We just do the practice. We're naturally.
Yeah. You know? No, I, you know, the Islam at its beginning, Islam modeled itself on the same practices that Christianity was using and had used, and that Judaism, I mean, Christianity's early practices were based in Judaism, were almost a one-to-one port over of those. So, you know, Islam is doing these spiritual practices, you know, these call to prayers, these intentional moments where you drop everything and you pray. Other practices as well within the Muslim community are the exact practices that were done by Christians, that were done by Jews, and yet the Islamic community maintain them. What is, I think I can say this concretely, what is the fastest growing religion right now in the world? I think it's Islam. I think that it is far and away seeing the greatest growth. And why is that? Because it models the early church's sacramental mindset. It models the early church's spiritual practices and spiritual disciplines, the use of liturgy, calling people into something that is specific, that is practice-based, that is not just based on doctrine or text, which is not resonating with this generation. And I don't think it will again for a long time.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I guess the practice that the modern evangelical Protestant church wants us to do is show up to their event and give them money. you know, and buy their book. Yeah. Vote. And vote.
Voting is a spiritual discipline.
No, I've heard that. Yeah. It's not in the Bible. Jesus never tells us.
I probably said it. But it's not.
That's not the Bible. And I just wouldn't.
He said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, Matt. That was a vote, right? They voted for Caesar.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and then the whole, like, marriage, sexuality thing, I had this thought, I just forgot it, but it came back to me. It's like, actually, Paul tells us not to get married, whereas, like, these folks that are, like, a very anti-LGBTQI community, they say it's biblical to get married, whereas Paul tells us, if you really want to be biblical, Paul tells us not to get married. So, anyways, it's funny.
Well, that was the one time Paul was wrong. Even Paul we're going to pick and choose on, right?
But those are the type of things people pick up on, the hypocrisies, you know, and when you make doctrine a thing, like when you live with the tension, then it you don't look like a hypocrite. But when you say the Bible says, you know, this is the authority, this is how it has to be, and then people see contradictions, then you lose all credibility, you know?
Yeah.
Good discussion, good talk. I'll do some news. Really, the biggest news is just really the follow-up on Driscoll. I mean, I guess this is worthy of a couple-week thing, but after
it just keeps going,
fascinating,
right?
You know, last week we when we talked, we some more information came out after that, you know, he tried to go behind the pastor's back that was leading this event and get his son to like lead a coup against his father. And then that pastor came out. Yeah.
Very evangelical.
Yeah. The coups.
Coups. Chaos. Behind the scene backstabbing.
Yeah. You and I both experienced those sorts of things. And so,
yeah, we've both experienced and seen it, right? Yeah.
And very, very prevalent. And then, you know, the pastor calls Driscoll out for, you know, just doing this for publicity's sake. And then, you know, to your point that you kind of brought up is you were doing research on the individual who was being, you know, called out kind of in the middle of it unnecessarily. Kind of his story came out through him. You know, he was a male stripper at one time. He came to Christ and gave that up, but continue to do these feats of strength, gymnastic strength really is what it is. And so he was kind of shocked by the whole thing and just was doing it as a service to God. And it sounds like it's kind of his ministry to go around and do these sorts of things for crowds and talk about Jesus and share his testimony, which is fascinating, you know? So
This guy's a professional. I mean, so he was a male stripper, gay or otherwise, I don't know. Who cares? I mean, and if you want to care, it's in his past. You know, I mean, we're not, if you care, it's still in his past. So who cares? Are you not going to let people down off the cross at some point? I mean, do you not believe in Reformation? Do you not believe in the power of God to save and change somebody? This dude says he's saved. It gives every indication that he's a follower of Jesus. And so, you know, I'm like, first of all, who cares? And second of all, who cares? He's a professional. He wasn't stripping on stage. He was not only doing performance art, he was doing highly technical art that nobody cared about until Mark Driscoll cared about. And then everybody cared about. The pastor said, I wouldn't have invited Driscoll or Alex, the sword swallower, to come. Why? Why was it about what Driscoll said you shouldn't have done that? Is it just because you got caught with your pants down? Like, what about last year with the tanks and the guns and the flag? Like,
what? He was more sorry.
Come on.
That was my start.
If you're going to repent for something, if you're going to repent for something, the former male stripper, sword swallowing gymnast who rips his shirt off and does feats around the pole is far less tragic than all of the other stuff that you do every single Sunday in that Christian nationalist church of yours. God and country, rah, rah. God bless America. I'll go watch the gay stripping sword swallower.
Oh, that's good. That'll preach. That was like, I'm sorry this happened apology, you know? Like, it's sad that dude got caught in the middle of all this and he was just trying to be do his thing. And
it is. Whenever you tangle with people like Driscoll, though, what do you expect? I mean, you know, you don't hold a rattlesnake and then be like surprised when you get bit by it, right? I mean, like, you're going to invite Driscoll to your event. Like, what, did you not expect there was going to be some sort of drama surrounding this? I mean, it's just, come on.
That's very true. Driscoll just brings drama. He always has. He always will.
There are people who do that, who their whole shtick is stirring up shit. I mean, maybe that's me too. Maybe I need to do some self-reflection here. It's not my whole shtick. Yeah. It's just, I'm an 8 or a 9 or somewhere between an 8 or a 9, which is like the worst place to be, right? I'm both peace and chaos.
You and me both. Yeah, I think
I'll just stir up the shit, and I'll help you clean it up.
I was used to say, I'll be an asshole to you, and then I'll try to fix it all. Driscoll, he had a big meltdown too on Twitter. I think he may need to see a therapist, but he probably will never see a therapist. No, Driscoll.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, he may see, he may need to. I think, yeah, he does. You know, Driscoll scares me. I've been thinking about that this week. Driscoll, there are a lot of guys out there who do Mark Driscoll, who do, you know, Donald Trump type stuff for clicks, for relevance, for, you know, just because they're narcissists. They can't help themselves being the center of attention. Even bad attention is attention. Driscoll a little bit scares me. I feel like Driscoll is, or has become at some point, one step beyond those things and those people. Driscoll, I think, really believes that everything he says, or he seems to believe that everything that he says is gold and is true and is of God. He strikes me as the kind of guy who sees himself as a prophet among idiots, and whom God is always on their side. And maybe this is just projection either from me or from him, but he kind of strikes me as the kind of guy who's going to end up in Central or South America with Kool-Aid. Like, I just like, Driscoll's the type of person who, to me, builds a tribe of dunces who are followers and then takes them off into somewhere and bad things happen. He really scares me. There are a lot of evangelical people who scare me, but Driscoll, like, just this, the whole thing this week is just like, this is beyond evangelical weird into like certifiably insane.
I agree. He's scary.
It worries me.
Like, I could see him doing that, or I could also see him like trying to lead an actual coup, like violently, you know, against somebody. Like, he's just off his,
of what?
I don't know. You know, I don't know. Like, I could just see him picking up arms and telling his congregation to take up arms, and you know, and it like, you don't know. He's like a loose cannon. You don't know what he's going to do. And I sense the similar things.
I hope that's not prophetic, Matt, but I bet we do see a pastor at church who does that someday. There's just way too much gun, Second Amendment pastors who are, you know, building tribes of people like Doug Wilson out in Nowheresville, Idaho. People who are creating David Koresh style, you know, compounds of people. Unfortunately, I hope you're not being prophetic, but it would not surprise me if at some point, whether it's Driscoll or somebody else, we see some confederacy of dunces calling a call to arms to their church and their tribe against some other individual church or tribe. That's terrifying, and yet also completely within the realm of the possibility, I think, where we are now in Christendom.
But when you name stuff like that you disagree with and hate, the Jezebel spirit, you know, that can naturally lead to a progression of violence towards people with Jezebel spirit and justify it spiritually. That we're just, you know, cutting this off, we're eliminating this. And it's scary, but I don't know if that'll happen, but I do think that Doug Wilson and Mark Driscoll are going to find themselves in the same room one day doing some conference together. They seem to be on a natural trajectory towards each other. I don't know if they've ever been in the same room together, but that's going to happen. You watch.
No room could hold the egos that would be present in those two.
That would be amazing. I might go just to see what happened.
No Astrodome. No Astrodome could hold. <You
know. laughs> Oh, man. Yeah, that was great. Wilson on did you see the Wilson on Tucker? Did you see that bit from like a week ago?
I saw that it happened, and I refused to listen to. There are some things that I'm just like, I'm just not going to do it. It may be helpful for podcasts or for tweeting or whatever, but I can't do it. And Doug Wilson and Tucker Carlson are two people who I will not give any voice or air to their words in my head.
It was like a 9-minute clip that they posted.
What I missed.
I didn't watch the whole thing because it was just like, it was just dumb. It was what you thought it would be, you know. It was about Christian nationalism and how you know, the progressives have made Christian nationalism the boogeyman, which was funny because Tucker's theory was that Biden and the progressive, evil progressives had made up the word Christian nationalism. And Doug Wilson did have to admit that he published a book that kind of like was the leading book on what Christian nationalism is. So he didn't say we coined the term, but, you know, pretty much they coined the term. Like, they're the ones who say it. And Tucker, I didn't think, realized that at first, which was kind of a humorous bit. But then, yeah, then it just got into their normal stuff. Yeah,
that is funny. I just think whatever Tucker thinks, you're great. I just think that says something.
Well, the fact he thinks Putin's a great leader should tell you everything. So, yeah. Putin, his voice. Yeah, anyways, that was interesting, but I agree with you. I try not to give space in my life to all that nonsense, but it's gaining traction, and there's different edges to it.
Well, I figure if you listen to it, I don't have to.
There's different edges, right? There's the Doug Wilson edge that's probably more extreme, but then there's also like the William Wolf edge with the Southern Baptist Convention that's still Christian nationalism, maybe not as extreme. Then there's the Owen Strachan version that's less extreme.
Yeah, who I don't think anybody listens to William Wolf. I just think William Wolf is like 95% publicity. Like, he's self-marketing. He says things about himself being great, but I don't think anybody really takes him seriously. There are a few people who leverage his voice a little, but in SBC, like, he's a joke.
Yeah, he is. He is, but he has a voice.
I mean, I have more experience in the SBC than he does.
That is very true. The SBC, I was actually there when I was in Nashville. I didn't realize the SBC headquarters was there in Nashville. And it was fascinating. I took a picture. The headquarters is on the same street as like this old Episcopal church that actually I was going to worship at the Episcopal church before I left, flew out. I wanted to take communion. And so I parked right across the street from the SBC, and I didn't realize I was there, and you could see the Episcopal church. So I took a picture, and I was like, oh, this will be a great content for something later. Just those two things right next to each other was fascinating to me. But yeah, and I think it was the oldest Episcopal church in Tennessee, in fact. You know, 1700 type deal, right next to the SBC. So, yeah, fascinating stuff. But when's the convention? It's always in the summer, right? That always creates a lot of good content for us, I think.
Yeah, it's usually in June.
Yeah, so that would be exciting. Yeah, I think William Wolf's... Yeah, I think he's like... building towards something at that convention, it seems like. So that'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. I would say don't discount Wolf, but Wolf's like that little annoying voice in your ear.
Yeah, you know, that little
gnat. Like, he's a nobody in the SBC. And if he becomes anybody in the SBC, it will just be people leveraging him then for himself. But they're not going to let him in inside. They don't. Yeah, he's not respected.
No, but Al Mohler, I was just kind of like giving typologies, but maybe Al Mohler is a better type than William Wolf. But they're kind of the same. I feel like they're the same person or views, just they go about it a little differently.
Yeah, the fact that William didn't, after Al Mohler's internship, the fact that William did not move to some position somewhere within the SBC after that thing with Al Mohler says a lot about how he is viewed within the SBC. It's an old boys club, and William Wolf is not an old boy in the SBC. He is trying to break into that from Trump and from a bull in a china shop. I mean, his entire resume in the SBC is like a couple of internships, but he also says that he's like the authority on all things new SBC and all that. I mean, when you're whatever, dude, you're the laughingstock of everybody who is anybody in the SBC.
To put out there that he,
it may not always be that way.
That he works for Trump or something. I mean, that's his biggest like selling point. because he worked for Trump, you know. But yeah.
Yeah. Well.
But anyways, there's a lot of Christian nationalism out there, and I think a lot of the noise is on the social media, but it finds its way into people. Like I'm amazed at some of the stuff I hear that I thought was just a discussion on social media that somehow makes its way into conversations I'm having with folks. So that stuff, you know, obviously out here on the streets, people don't get as nuanced as you do on social media, but those influences are there and they get out there. You know, news picks those things up because they're looking for stuff to talk about. You know, it gets broadcast. So I think something to be aware of and deal with. And it's not a boogeyman created by Joe Biden, as much as Tucker would like to think.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, the biggest thing with Christian nationalism, and I think both sides are kind of warring over that term and whether it's good or bad. You know, the Doug Wilson, some people are trying to kind of own it as a positive thing and say that, you know, what's wrong with us being a nation that is given, you know, to the ideas of Christ. First of all, that's not... There are lots of other people who live in this land who are not followers of Christ, and that's why this land was created, so that there could be freedom of religion and expression, not freedom to only believe what you believe. Like, that's why we came here, right? That was part of the ideology that founded this place, was the freedom to believe what you want to believe or nothing at all. And so even just this idea that Christians believe that it's now right or okay to say, no, freedom of religion is not, you know, or freedom from religion is not what we believe in. We want everybody to adhere to the dogmas that we believe in. First of all, that just doesn't pass the smell test. But second of all, Jesus never says to do that. There's no even secondary reading of Jesus or of Scripture that implies that this is a good thing. In fact, at every turn, Jesus kind of gives the middle finger to this idea of empire and being crowned an empire. In fact, that kind of the joke, you know, the crown of thorns and the purple robe that they put on him there during the beating is again this idea that Jesus was the antithesis of all these things, the king of the Jews. That was a joke, right? Because he didn't want that, and he pushed that away, and the people wanted it. And it's like it just totally doesn't resonate at all with Scripture. This idea of a Christian nation.
You mean Jesus didn't say go make a Christian nation?
That's the problem, right? The problem is Jesus.
Well, these folks like
no, these no, I don't think he like did. And if you can point it out to me somewhere in the
no, they like to ignore Jesus. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah, well, we don't care what Jesus wants or says because it conflicts with what we say and what we want. And I think that's the point. Whenever people are trying to sell you on these things.
Yeah, like.
Don't buy it.
That's the problem with having a vision to like conquer the world for Jesus is like, you're not going to. Like, in America.
Onward
we're
Christian
never
soldiers.
Going to be, I would say it,
marching us
we're
to
never
war.
Going to be a Christian nation again. Maybe in the beginning of this country we were, because that's all that was here was people who professed to be Christians. But now we live amongst Jews, Muslims, Hindus, you know, you name it, Mormon. Like there's so many different faiths, religions, what have you. It's not changing. It's not going to change. No matter what you do, Doug Wilson, no matter what crazy strategy you have, Stephen Furtick, you know, who fill in the blank, Mark Driscoll, how many Jezebels you call out, you're not going to convert the entire United States to follow Jesus. It's not happening. Never. And so just stop. Just stop. You know, the only way maybe you could do it is if you, you know, use violence and then people like submitted. Like we did to the slaves, we just forced them to, you know, convert to Christianity and by violence. But that's it. I mean, it's not happening until, you know, Jesus comes back. But the fascinating thing to think about is when Jesus is here with us, and maybe I don't know how it all plays out, but I wonder if he just lets people continue in their previous faith and cultural identities. I don't think that we're all going to have one unique cultural identity that looks like modern Christianity. I'll leave it at that. But people,
I just think it's funny. What does it say about you that you have to enforce your faith rather than people wanting to come to your faith? I just, like, you know, why are you enforcing all of these things that are, you know, tenets of your faith? Shouldn't your faith just be something that people really want to be a part of? Like, that just says something about your faith. Maybe you need to rethink your belief systems and the reality of, like, people flocked to Jesus, but they're running away from you. maybe you should rethink who you're standing beside if you think that enforcing all of your beliefs is the way to go, because Jesus didn't have to do that.
Yeah, I had a great conversation with a Muslim man last week about Jesus. He believes in Jesus, you know? Like, he said all the things that you would want my former evangelical evangelism self would want him to say about Jesus. Yeah, he's Muslim. And he's not going to convert to Christianity, but yeah, he likes Jesus. He loves Jesus. He, you know, has a view on Jesus that that would align with a lot of the ways we view Jesus. So yeah, I just don't know. Jesus is very popular among other faiths, but less, in some ways, less popular among our own faith. The actual Jesus and how he actually lived.
Well, we don't need Jesus. We have Paul.
Yeah. Well, that's it. That's just it.
Or our re-rendering of Paul. Paul is much easier to run through our filter and come out with the biases that we want than Jesus is. I would submit that we've misunderstood most of Paul, but we love Paul because Paul is much easier to mess with than Jesus is.
Well, and Paul talks a lot more practically. So it's a little bit easier to try to apply what Paul says to our everyday life, where Jesus spoke in story and parable, and he actually lives things out. So it's a little harder to apply that. But yeah, and yeah, I mean, that could be another episode. Maybe we'll dive into that sometime. But about Paul and Jesus differences. But
write that down.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah. So how's the fitness? How goes it? How's the injury that you've been coming off of?
Today was, bothering me a little bit, so I took it easy. I mean, I still went and did a CrossFit bike workout, but I didn't do the squats. I did shoulder press instead. So just trying to, like, it's not in pain, so I want to keep it that way. But so when I feel it at all, any twinge, I, you know, am careful with it, so I don't go back to not being able to do anything, which I was at that point. So yeah, not too bad. Today is the first day in like 3 weeks that it felt that way, so not too bad. But I'm on the diet grind again, so about 2 weeks in, so I'm hoping that I can continue that.
No. Oh, that's right. You did say that last week, didn't you?
And not,
I'm sorry. The Lord bless you and keep you.
Yeah. Like, I had to deny, like, I came from a luncheon for senior citizens, and, you know, they built a very Southern comfort, feed your feelings type meal. And I was like, I sorry, I can't eat this.
They know how to eat.
Yeah.
As a pastor, you always learn that you go to the senior, you know, lunches and meals because they know how to cook and they know how to eat. Yeah. Like, it's always good stuff.
I felt bad turning it down, but I needed to.
No offense. The singles, never go to the singles events expecting great food. You go to the singles events expecting phenomenal conversation and a whole lot of fun.
Yeah.
Seniors events, you're always go to for the food.
Exactly. And the desserts. It was tough turning down those desserts too, but, yeah, so we'll see if I get.
Yeah, so what does dieting look like to, like, what do you follow? What do you do? Is there a rhythm? Are you doing something different than you normally do?
No, I'm tracking macros. I don't know. I've been on so many diets over the years, but right now I'm doing a pretty significant calorie.
Right, preaching the choir.
Yeah, calorie deficit. For the first like month, and then I'm gonna you know, do some more maintenance, but still cutting calories like RP style after the first month. I just kind of want to reset for a month and then get to a create good structure, good foundation, and then like do the RP diet thing after that. So I'm about heading into week three. I've stuck with it, my plan so far. So I feel pretty good about that. So we'll see how it goes. But I feel
it's no fun, but it does work.
It does, and I know you. The thing is when you work out every day, you definitely notice a difference in the way when you're working out. Like you notice that you're eating healthier. Like it definitely has a direct correlation. So yeah, you don't notice it as much if you don't work out. I'll say that. But yeah, I, and my biggest problem over the last couple of years has been just like dealing with all the crap in my life. And so I'm trying to get a healthier, you know, way of dealing with just the bullshit that comes my way. I haven't been good at that, so I'm trying to get better at that. Yeah, that's me.
Yeah, pastors deal with so much stress. It's incredible just the amount of stress and the toll it takes on the body, just the mental stress, the emotional stress, the relational stress. There's no the schedule of a pastor, especially the schedule of a pastor who is under attack or is in a season of chaos. Is just tremendously tight, and it takes a toll. So, I'm proud of you for, you know, attacking at it again. The hard part I think with those seasons are a lot of times you can't predict them, and so you just kind of have to roll with it and put your mind and body into it for a while. And then some pastors, when they come out of it, never able to recover. And so you've always been the kind of guy who recovers well and who's a fighter. So I got no doubts you'll get to wherever you want to be.
Thanks, man. How's your stuff going? How's your new coach? You last week you talked about you got a new coach.
Yeah, things are... Yeah, I got a new coach. The coach increased my food intake, increased my carbs, actually. So... I feel like I'm at a high weight, and so when he increased the carbs, but he wanted my energy to go up. So I have this love-hate relationship with carbs. I feel like I'm not supposed to hate carbs whenever I'm dieting, but I do. Like, I love to eat carbs, but I'm always really scared of carbs. So he increased my carbs. I was like freaking out because he increased my carbs. And now it's like I can't get down the amount of rice and oatmeal that he wants. Like, it's so much food, so many carbs. I'm like, this doesn't feel like a diet. Like I feel like I should be longing for more food rather than like forcing myself to stuff food down. But I am, and lost 3 pounds in the last week, which I thought was weird. I'm like, did I do something wrong? He's like, no, you're doing fine. But he didn't explain what was going on. So I'm like, all right, whatever. Lose an inch other ways, lose 3 pounds. Like, whatever. And I gotta ask. I don't know how that happens. What, you know, voodoo you're doing with eating more food and that happening, but whatever, it is what it is. And you might have said, I had been saying I'm drinking a gallon of water a day for a long time, but I hadn't been. And so like a week ago, I'm like, all right, I'll start drinking the gallon of water every day. And so, yeah, here we are. And I'll tell you, a man my age, when he drinks a gallon of water during the day, he feels it all through the night. Yeah. About every 45 minutes. When he gets up, so that's like, it's just back and forth night between me and the toilet because of this wonderful gallon of water.
I'm doing the same thing, actually. That's part of it. I'm trying to drink a gallon of water every day. Yeah, it's a lot of trips to the bathroom. Yep.
Yeah, so the joke is I'm really pissed off about this, having to drink all of this water, but yeah, it's a bad joke. old man, but at least everything's running clear, which I learned is actually, you know, in my training for a certified personal trainer, it's actually not a good thing. You're not supposed to have clear urine. Everybody was always like, your urine should be clear so you know whether you're healthy. No, it should be very light yellow. So there you go. Mine's clear, which means I'm unhealthy, but I'm following the culture's rules, so I don't even care. If I die, at least I'll die full of water.
Coach, more important.
I'll float. At this point, yes, it's just yes, sir. Just tell me what to do. Yes, yeah, sir. Yeah. I just want to get on the stage. I want to get through this season of my life and move on. I want to let my body go and live like everybody else, eat all the comfort food that the seniors create and do so without guilt, put on the root beer belly and just coast until my heart attack or stroke. Which I should make jokes. I should make jokes like that, but I'm getting old. I'm like 46 years old. I'm like, you know, whatever. I've been a pastor. I know the heart conditions in my family. At best, I've got 4 to 6 more years left in me. And then who knows? It's borrowed time after that.
Man, that's morbid. I hope you live longer than 6 more years.
This might be a good place to end.